91.3 WLRN presents Topical Currents. Today's program begins with good news from the Miami-Dade city of Opa-locka. Good afternoon, Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman. Opa-locka has taken its image lumps, but it dates back to 1926 when Glenn Curtis and James Bright created a startling suburb with Moorish architecture. There are streets named Alibaba, Sherazade, Aladdin, and Sesame. We'll visit with two activist achievers and learn about Opa-locka's arts and design upswing. And more, Linda Gastenheimer turns to chef Tanner Gilles and sommelier Heath Porter for Super Bowl bash tips. Much more than nachos and light beer. That's next. First, the news. And it is today's Topical Currents. Joseph Cooper with you this afternoon. Bonnie Berman is a tad under the weather today. I'm sure she'll be back to work Monday and be back on the air with me. So we begin the hour focused on Miami-Dade's coolest named city. That would be Opa-locka. Now, to be correct, the name Opa-locka is hyphenated, and the L in locka is always lowercase. It's known for its Moorish Revival-style buildings and historic airfield, and also, of course, the flea market. And we're now joined by Jermaine Barnes, who has the job of designer-in-residence. He came to the Opa-locka Community Development Corporation in 2013. He's an architect, city planner, and artist. Welcome to you, Jermaine Barnes. Thanks for coming downtown for us.
Thank you so much for having me.
And with us is the Arts and Creative Industry Manager for the Opa-locka Community Development Corporation. She's Eileen Alan. Is that correct?
Close.
Alan.
Yes.
There we go. She oversees the development, funding, and promotion of the Arts Master Plan Initiative in Opa-locka. Welcome to you, Eileen.
Thank you so much.
I'd like to begin with you. How do the arts figure in Opa-locka's revitalization?
Well, the arts have always played a role in the city of Opa-locka. It was founded on the basis of beauty, of unique architecture, of having pretty much everything that you would want in the city within walking distance. And so the city of Opa-locka was actually founded by an aviation pioneer, Glenn Curtis, and he was completely enthralled by the 1001 Tales of Arabian Nights. And he had his architect, Bernhard Mueller, design the city's original buildings based off of those tales. Over the course of the city's history, you know, the Great Depression, the city founder's death, World War II, and segregation, desegregation, a lot of crime, all of that kind of art, culture, beauty, unfortunately, came to a demise. But in 2010, the Opa-locka Community Development Corporation was awarded a grant from the Housing and Urban Development Group. And so with this grant, it allowed the organization to really expand its focus on not just affordable housing, which it had done very successfully for the past 30 years, but it allowed us to look more into what the people, what the neighborhood really needed and wanted in their communities. And the arts and culture were one of those things. So in 2011, I was brought on to really spearhead the artistic initiatives in the city. And then Jermaine was brought on a couple of years later as our designer in residence.
Jermaine Barnes, I saw a quote of yours called "Galvanize with the Arts." What drew you to Opa-locka, and what does that mean to galvanize with the arts?
What drew me to Opa-locka was a pretty unique opportunity to live a real life version of my architectural thesis, which I started to explore during graduate school in Los Angeles. And it was the idea that the built environment influences culture and race and ethnicity. And so to be able to work in an area that is impoverished and most would consider blighted, to be able to use the arts as a rallying cry, so to speak, to garner support for the area and to bring it back to its glory, which it experienced when it was first created.
I remember a couple of months ago that when Art Basel was here, that they had an event in Opa-locka. I was glad to see that. How did that go over?
It went very well, actually. A lot of people, I think, at first were skeptical about Opa-locka becoming part of the Art Basel scene. But over the years, I feel like we have become pretty successful. Just this past December, we had over 350 people at our big Basel party, despite the rain on a Friday night. And we're competing with, you know, Wynwood, Design District Downtown, and the beach. So it's definitely becoming a place to go for the arts and culture.
Could it become a reality that Opa-locka could maybe become, say, the next Wynwood or something like that, and really attract a wide variety of an artistic community and high-tech businesses?
I think we have to be careful in saying what Opa-locka can become and what it wants to become. We don't want to be seen as, you know, a Wynwood. Wynwood has its own place in Miami's cultural community. We want Opa-locka to still have its, you know, historical background and to have its own place, to make its own unique cultural, contribution to Miami's artistic community.
And Jermaine, what would that be?
I think the largest thing is understanding that you can capitalize on the efforts and the talents of those individuals that already call Opa-locka home to revitalize an area. And so I think, as Eileen mentioned before, we have to be careful of trying to mimic other areas simply because those are unique to their own conditions. Opa-locka is a very interesting area in that it's bordered by quite a few intersections of traffic. So you have the Palmetto, you have 95, you have State Road 9. You also have the large airport that's there. So we have to be cognizant of the fact that we don't have a lot of the same luxuries that some other areas have. So we have to be able to use the resources at our disposal and then make those the crown and jewel of the arts revitalization. And that's if someone in the town has a artistic skill, whether that's culinary or something as far as model making or craftsmanship, things of those nature, those are the ones that we start to promote as opposed to the traditional arts in the sense of multiple galleries and high tech and things of that nature.
Something you said, Jermaine Barnes, that struck me. You're calling it something beautiful decay. Could you define that? Let me know what that really means.
Gotcha. So Beautiful Decay was an exhibition that the OLCDC allowed me to put on with the help of a fellow colleague at University of Miami, Joaquin Perez. And so the idea was to find these locations across the continental United States that most people see as blighted communities and ones that are demolishing right before our eyes. And the genesis of the proposal was that a lot of architects and designers look at architecture as permanent. And they want to design the next Eiffel Tower or the next landmark that defines a city. And in my experience, I've learned that everything has an expiration date. Why is architecture special in that it does not have an expiration date? And I think Opa-locka is a great example of that, in that a lot of the old Moorish revival architecture that's there has started, it was not maintained as well as it should have been. So a lot of the buildings are now in poor shape than when they were first built. But at the same time, there's beauty in the decay of those buildings. Now you see ones that are overrun with beautiful shrubbery. You see other buildings like the Historic City Hall that you might drive past. And while it might look like a ruin, it still is able to see the history that's within it. And so the idea of the Beautiful K was to show off landscapes across the country that all deal with circumstances that are beyond our control. And that's basically that time is undefeated.
Both Jermaine and Eileen, could you both address the delicate balance of revitalization and not gentrification and having people not be able to afford to live in Opa-locka?
So I want to be try to be as clearly as possible with this. You have to have a little bit of gentrification whenever you're doing any kind of redevelopment. It would be naive to believe that you can spur redevelopment without any whatsoever. So I don't want to create a misnomer that we want to do 100% without gentrification. Technically, Eileen and I, both being transplants from other states are the very definition of gentrification. But at the same time, you don't have to price out your core your core group of people that live there in the area. So that's, can we have community meetings so that we're able to keep them involved in what's going on? Can we find out what their talents are so that they're able to benefit just as much as we are? Can we work in partnership so that we don't have to take on the entire role of revitalizing everything on our own? If it becomes a group and community endeavor, then we're all able to thrive, and then we're all able to move the city forward, as opposed to having a select few individuals with unlimited funds come in and do it for us.
Eileen, tell us a little more of your background and how you came to Opa-locka. You also were with the city of Miami for a spell.
Sure. My background is actually, I'm from South Carolina, born and raised, and I moved to Miami about 6 years ago. And I came here, well, one, I wanted something different from where I had grown up. And I had received a job offer from City Year Miami, which is a local nonprofit. And it's really looking at the high school dropout rate and how to reduce it.
Oh, yeah, we've had them on, yeah.
Right. And so I was working with a middle and high school leadership development program where we talked about different social issues with the students who came from all around Miami-Dade. So that's when I was first exposed to Opa-locka, at the same time that I was exposed to, you know, Homestead, to Miami Beach, to Hialeah, to Brownsville, Liberty City, everywhere in between. And we brought these 100 kids together on Saturdays and talked about what are the problems in their community, and how can they be the agents of change in them. And so I took some of my art history and my artistic background and did some murals with them and a different artistic type of programming. And after that job, it was only a one-year program through an AmeriCorps program. I did another AmeriCorps program called Public Allies Miami, and that's really focused on young people who, again, want to create change in their communities. And so through Public Allies, I was fortunate to be placed with the Opa-locka CDC as they were looking for someone to kind of spearhead their arts initiatives, while I was looking for a community-based organization where I could use my artistic background. And from there, I was really fortunate to be hired after one year, and I've been there for about 4.5 years, almost 5 years.
It's quite a story. And Jermaine Barnes, a little thumbnail of your background, Chicago guy.
Yeah, born in the Midwest, go Bulls. So went to undergrad, University of Illinois, Champaign-Urbana, architecture background, studied there. Left at the height of the beginning of the recession, went to South Africa for a bit, worked in an office in Cape Town. Really started to learn more about myself and how my entire life had been living at the border between blighted communities and thriving communities. And then went to Los Angeles for graduate school, got my master's in architecture, and then as a part of a team that submitted a proposal to the Opa-locka Community Development Corporation to revitalize a neighborhood in Opa-locka via the arts and architecture. We were fortunate to be one of the teams that were selected, and a part of our proposal was me moving into the actual neighborhood to actually find out what the community members thought would help them, because it's one thing to want to help from a distance, but it's another to actually live there and experience the problems yourself and have a rapport with the individuals. And I came here in February of 2013, and now 3 years later, here we are.
And you live in Opa-locka.
I do. I live in the area. I live in Opa-locka. I live in the neighborhood that we're redeveloping. It's now known as Magnolia North. Used to be known as the Triangle. A lot of individuals probably know that name because it was had the highest murder rate in the entire country at one point in time. But now that narrative is changing quite a bit. A lot of the individuals that live there now are working class individuals. They leave at 9 in the morning. They come back at 5 p.m. The OLCDC is doing a wonderful job as far as providing fantastic housing for individuals that want to move there at a lower rate, because it's, as we know, as a young person in the city, it's extremely difficult to find affordable housing within Miami-Dade County. And so me living there is more of a, I live there. I'm not just speaking from a distance. I see it every day. I work there in the city. So I have a true one-to-one relationship with the redevelopment.
We're talking about Opa-locka on today's Topical Currents. We'll take a short break and be back with more.
Opa-locka Hialeah is the place to go. It's more than just a market, it's a great big show. Opa-locka.
Opa-laka Hialeah is a thing to do. Every time you go, you find something new. Opa-laka Hialeah. Opa-laka Hialeah is for you and me. And the hits just keep on coming. Opa-laka Hialeah, if you haven't been to the flea market, you should try it. It's on Lejeune Road, just a little south of 135th Street. And there's a lot of fun going on there. Tell me, Eileen, Alan, we're also talking to Jermaine Barnes about the ARC. That's the Arts and Recreation building.
So the ARC is OLCDC's new kind of artistic and community center.
I saw before and after pictures. It's amazing.
Right. It is incredible. It used to be the Thompson Roofing Company building. And so we acquired it about last year. And we held our first, or no, 2 years ago, sorry. And we've been in the process of renovating it to house both the arts and creative industry office space as well as a gallery multi-purpose flex space. But it also includes an outdoor courtyard, kind of a backyard area, which will become an urban farm and pop-up marketplace. So it's really becoming the hub for our activity and services in downtown Opa-laka.
If someone isn't familiar with Opa-laka and want to just kind of get a sense of the place, where should they go? What should they see to get a feel for it?
I would definitely say that they need to drive down Alibaba and Opa-laka Boulevard, and they'll see some of the best examples of the historic Moorish Revival architecture. Our historic City Hall is on Opa-laka and Sherazade Boulevard. Even the OLCDC's main office is in a historic building that used to be a hotel, a gas station, a community center, a restaurant. The train station, which is actually right next to the Tri-Rail station, is also in a historic building. And Crabman 305 is another great local food entrepreneur that you should visit.
Crabman 305.
Yes.
That sounds interesting.
Delicious.
How about the Meta that you were talking about earlier, Jermaine?
So one of the great things about the Arts and Recreation Center is that we're able to have monthly programming. And so yearly now, we're able to host a program that we're calling Meta, which allows us to have a rotating amount of programs and projects every single month. And so what happens is we get a curator. He creates an idea for a show, and then use typically the third Sunday of the month from 1 until 4 p.m. We have an event to kick off that month's show. So since it's February, this is Black History Month. And then in March, it's Women's Month. And then in April, it's Poetry Month. So every single month, we have a new idea. We have a new show based around the arts. And we do this from January until August. And then when August comes, we gear up for our yearly Art of Transformation event, which is our big culminating event to kind of show all the things that we've accomplished throughout the year and how we plan to move forward for the next year.
How do you see Opa-laka in a couple of years? Is it going to be steady improvement? Do you expect that?
I would hopefully expect that. And I do see change happening. Like I said, I started working in Opa-laka in 2011. And while it seems that the changes have been slow to come, I've definitely seen changes in the past 4 years. And just the other day, Jermaine and I were talking about how maybe a year or two ago, someone said that Presidente Supermarket would never come to Opa-laka. And lo and behold, there's a Presidente Supermarket sign that's right on Opa-laka Boulevard saying, coming here soon. So you see these businesses coming to Opa-laka, you see even local businesses popping up and starting to thrive. And you see different people coming into the city, both to live, both to visit, whether it's at the Arts and Recreation Center or elsewhere, because they hear, you know, there's the flea market, there's Crabman 305, there's this, and this, there's this architecture. People are starting to hear more positive things about Opa-laka. And I feel like that's only going to continue growing.
Jermaine Barnes, maybe some of your college colleagues or work colleagues, how do you tell them about Opa-laka and what it means to you and the vision of Opa-laka?
To be honest with you, a lot of them thought I was crazy to leave sunny Los Angeles and move to Opa-locka. They said, why are you leaving LA? You live right by Hollywood. This makes no sense whatsoever. Even my family thought I was losing my marbles. But the biggest thing is I've always felt that architecture can have an impact. And so when I try to explain to them what we're doing in the area, I'm saying this is one of those projects that can change things. It changed me as a person. And none of this would be possible without the leadership that we have at the OLCDC. The CEO, Dr. Logan, and the Vice President, Stephanie Williams-Baldwin, allow Eileen and I a lot of freedom to maneuver around in the arts world and then find our niche and find out how we can help support things at the office so that you see two 30 and under year old fresh faces are allowed to kind of just do what we want, are given carte blanche to try to help and revitalize an area, which is something typically you don't see. So when I tell my former graduate school buddies that are off at the famous architects' offices and they have the name and the notoriety behind their resumes, I'm able to say, well, I'm actually changing a full city.
So rather than being entry level at a big firm,
exactly, right,
you're getting hands on while you're still in your youth.
Exactly.
Relatively.
Yep.
Well, it's certainly been an encouraging thing to hear about Opa-locka. We've been joined by Jermaine Barnes. He has the job of designer in residence at Opa-locka, the Community Development Corporation. He's an architect, city planner, and artist. Thank you for coming on our program, Jermaine.
Thank you so much for
having me. And also, we had the arts and creative industry manager for the Opa-locka Community Development Corporation. She's Eileen Allan. And we certainly thank you for this coming on as well, Eileen.
Thank you so much. It was a pleasure to be on.
Food and Dining is next. And it is today's Topical Currents. Joseph Cooper with you this afternoon. Bonnie Berman's just a little under the weather. So it's time for Linda Gassenheimer. She's our favorite chef, author, and syndicated columnist. Now for the rest of the hour, she'll lead us in tips for an outstanding Super Bowl bash. We do this every year. Linda, if you favor Carolina, I suppose pulled pork sandwiches would be apropos. Now, Colorado at your party, I'm not sure, but I did find a recipe online for elk ossobuco.
I saw on television this morning that they think they invented the cheeseburger in Denver.
Of course, there are also things called Rocky Mountain oysters.
That's another story. Okay, what's the best part of the evening besides the game? Of course, it's the food. And Super Bowl ranks second in food consumption to Thanksgiving. So we've got your food game plan today. Uvagia Wine Bar chef Tanner Gill has some ideas for us. So welcome, Chef Tanner.
Hello.
Great to have you with us. And to help us with the wine to go with Chef Tanner's food is Uvagia Sommelier, better known, and I don't know why, he calls himself the head wino.
Because I'm in charge of all the other winos.
Okay, fine. That's Heath Porter. Welcome, Heath.
Thanks for having me. I'm your local pusher.
Okay, whatever that means. Now, we're also going to be talking, he'll be talking with Fred Tasker about drinks for the day. I don't know if I'm going to let him talk to Fred. We'll see.
That could be dangerous.
Exactly.
That's the game plan.
Okay, so we'd love to hear from you, our listeners. What are your favorite Super Bowl foods? Or maybe have some questions for our guests. Give us a call. That's 800-743-9576, 800-743-WLRN. I guess without Bonnie, we have no email?
No, forgot to do it. My fault.
Okay, so give us a call, 800-743-WLRN. We'd love to hear from you. And as I mentioned, we're also talking with our favorite wine guy, Fred Tasker. You can read Fred's wine suggestions for my Dinner in Minutes column in the Miami Herald, and you can also read his wine column in Saturday's Miami Herald. Fred, is it wine or beer, or what do we got, both? What are we going to do today?
Oh, we're going to talk about wine matches for Super Bowl snacks, and then I want to chat with our guests about their South Beach Wine Festival event. Sounds like a very good event.
There's going to be some sort of a slam going on, I think.
Yeah.
All right. Okay, so what do you think is the most popular food for Super Bowl?
Nachos. Chili.
Keep going.
Hamburgers. Chicken wings.
Uh-huh.
There we go.
1 billion chicken wings will be eaten during Super Bowl. That's about 100 pounds of chicken wings. Also, 10 million pounds of ribs are sold the week of Super Bowl. Now, I have to say, though, that those statistics come from the chicken board and the pork board. But otherwise, I think they're probably pretty accurate, considering. Chef Tanner, everyone's going to be watching the game. No one wants to be in the kitchen, except in my house, everybody comes into the kitchen and watch there. So give us an idea. What can we make ahead of time?
Well, I think a great thing that you can make ahead of time is queso. I'm from Texas, and that's something that we eat a lot of there. And it's something you can kind of put together in a crock pot or something and have with a big bowl of chips.
Wait, what is queso?
Queso is like a melted cheese dip.
Uh-huh.
In Texas, you know, a lot of places they use like Velveeta cheese, but you can use some evaporated milk and Chihuahua cheese from Mexico, and you can throw
Chihuahua cheese?
Uh-huh.
Okay, I'm from New England, so you're going to have to explain Chihuahua cheese.
Chihuahua cheese is kind of like, I think like Monterey Jack cheese, you know,
okay.
It's sort of these, you know, native cheeses down there, but they melt really well, they're nice and white and creamy, and you can put some jalapenos in there if you like, or just some diced tomatoes.
Now why powdered milk, did you say?
Evaporated milk.
Oh, evaporated milk. Okay, mm-hmm. Right. Okay. Oh, that would make it nice and creamy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And sweet.
Yes, very much so. Yeah, I like to put like Mexican chorizo in there, or maybe you could do like some crumbled, you know, like some ground beef cooked up with some taco seasoning or something like that. But that's always one of my favorite things.
So you put it in a crock pot and just leave it for how just to melt it, or do you have to cook it?
No, you have to cook it. I mean, you have to cook it all, and then you could put it in something to keep it warm, like a crock pot. You like boil the milk with a little bit of water, and then throw your cheese in there, and your cooked meat and your cooked veggies and stuff, and eat it with dip, or eat it with chips.
Why wouldn't you just start with whole milk or half and half or something?
It just doesn't work quite as well as when you do with evaporated milk, and also a little drop of oil kind of keeps everything sort of flowing. Otherwise, it'll sort of solidify if you don't do it without evaporating.
You don't want that.
No. That sounds really good, though, doesn't it? Okay. And also, you've brought something here in the studio. It's brisket, so tell us about that.
Sure. I brought a serving of the brisket that we have on our menu at Uvaggio. And this is sort of an Asian kind of inspired brisket dish. And, you know, for the barbecue fans who are from Carolina, or maybe you're going for Carolina this weekend, you could do something similar, but maybe, you know, a little more black pepper, a little garlic salt, something like that, and then make a little nice Carolina barbecue sauce to go with it instead.
Oh, yeah, this is really good.
He doesn't often say that, but you know what? It's beef, and so he loves beef.
Well, thank you very much.
So
finally, don't get something that's not made out of turkey.
Fred?
We're in cahoots on that turkey stuff.
Yep.
I always
it's all
give,
foul.
Because he thinks I always give him turkey sausage, which is true. Anyway, so you said, well, what is a Carolina barbecue sauce?
So here in Carolina, the barbecue sauce they tend to make is sort of a mixture of vinegar and like kind of hot pepper sauce. It's a little runnier. It's not quite so thick. You know,
it's not like a sugary, tomato-y based sauce.
No. You don't typically do tomato in there at all. So it's basically just like a apple cider vinegar and brown sugar and some hot sauce, some red pepper flake maybe, and you just kind of bring it up to a boil and let it cool off. And then you get this nice, runny, tangy, really tangy barbecue sauce.
Wow, I think he's making everybody really, really hungry. So let me ask you, what kind of beef do you have for your brisket? Because this one just falls apart. It's wonderful.
I just do like a typical brisket, and you kind of, if you go down towards the leaner end, you'll end up with a little bit.
Well, what if I go to the market? What do I ask for?
A brisket, just a whole. You can ask for a whole brisket. They can buy. I mean, typically you want to get it cut down into smaller pieces because.
Yeah, it's pretty big.
Yeah, a whole brisket is about 3 feet long, and so you're going to want
to
get cut into a smaller
piece. This isn't television,
piece.
So he's cooking with his hands as he's talking.
Sorry.
And the 3 feet, he's holding his hands up.
You know, you can ask for, you know, a piece of brisket from your butcher at your grocery store.
You want the leaner end.
The leaner end, yeah, absolutely.
And I noticed that you cut it into smaller pieces, like 3 or 4 pieces.
Uh huh. Yeah.
And then, I usually
start with like some kind of a rub, you know, some salt and some sugar and some spices. You know, you can sort of vary what you want to put in there based on your taste.
Maybe some cumin.
Exactly. Yeah. You know, garlic powder. You know.
I'm impressed, Joe.
And then, you know, rub it down and let it soak for, you know, let it sit for about 8 hours, and it'll kind of concentrate some of that flavor. And then you kind of wash it off, wash off the rub. And then I usually put it in a bigger pot and sear it, the outside of it. And then after you get it seared, you can kind of throw it in sort of a roasting pan, put some beef stock in there, cover it with some foil, maybe a couple carrots and onions and things, and let it braise for a couple of hours until it's nice and tender.
What temperature in the oven?
I would say about 300 degrees. Yeah, depending on how big your cut of meat is. If it's a lot bigger and
that's
thicker.
Higher than what you normally read about for brisket. But
yeah.
Well, but you have to get it going first on top of the stove, and
that's right.
Then you put it in the
yeah.
oven.
Right.
But you have some. You put some other flavorings in because we're tasting it here, and it's not just the stock and carrots and onions. So what else is in there?
Well, the one that we make at the restaurant, we actually we cook sort of in a confit style in rendered beef fat. Which is a little harder. It's a little harder.
Now you're talking.
That's a little harder to come by. It took me a couple of months to get enough beef fat sort of saved up to do it that way. But that gives it a little bit more of a tenderness.
And also there's some...
The dashi.
Yeah, the dashi. Thank you, Keith. What else is in there?
On the
what
dish,
else do you put in it? Yes.
On the dish we serve, we make a dashi, which is sort of like a traditional Japanese style... broth that's made with kombu, which is dried seaweed, and also katsuobushi, which is a dried bonita fish flake. And so you kind of make a stock with that. Then we also...
It's kind of strange bedfellows for brisket.
It is, sort of, yeah. We also throw some bacon into the dashi while it's cooking.
You're making Joe's day. He's so happy.
So you get kind of a smoky flavor to add in, kind of bolsters that beefiness.
Okay. So, well, if you'd like that whole recipe... the recipe without the rendered fat, but with the beef stock, it's at dinnerinminutes.com, plus a photograph of the dish. So it's really very, very good. Well, we're sitting here with Heath Porter, who brought in a cooler full of wine. So what are we drinking to go with this brisket?
I brought the juice buggy. Yes, absolutely.
Yeah, the juice buggy. Okay. Yeah. I've got some juice in my glass here.
You do have some juice. You got some adult Kool-Aid there.
Fred just fell over in Michigan.
Yes, okay. I did. I'll be in about 20 minutes.
Come on, Fred. I got the sparkling juice waiting for you. Come on down.
I'm ready.
So we're going to go to Spain with this. This is a wine I call the Malbec Slayer. We don't carry any Malbec or any sorts of wines like that around Uvagio. But I've got a Abadía de Gomariz,
say it slowly.
Abadía de Gomariz. Comes from the Ribera, not to be confused with the Ribera del Duero in Spain. And it's a couple indigenous grapes that you don't see a lot, Susan, Farol, and Menthia. And it's just really cool. It's got a nice, lush, ripe mouthfeel to it. It doesn't have too much structure to overwhelm the savory and the umami of the dashi. But then it's just got enough body fill and enough minerality to really pick up on all of those complex layers of flavor. You know, you don't want to put something too crazy next to the dish and screw up everything.
So this is a wine that would go well with the brisket and other foods at Super Bowl, or...?
Absolutely. I mean, you were talking about your nice juicy ribs with the sauce dropping down to the end of the elbow and all those things, and this can handle those things. It handles spice really well. It's not too high in alcohol, so when you get all that spice together with it, it doesn't really blow up the complete pairing to it. So yeah, anything pretty full-bodied and red meat, that type of thing, definitely works well with it.
So
sounds like it doesn't have a huge amount of tannin either.
No, and that's what I'm looking for. I think, Fred, you don't want too much structure to it, because those tannins, they like fat, but they like more of a fattiness on a ribeye as opposed to something that's low and slow that gets to be a little bit firmer like the brisket.
Yeah, so that's right.
So it's Abadía.
Abadía. It's just actually going to be a river that runs right through the community. And then the Gomariz. And Gomariz is the small village that's right there next to the river as well.
Now, is that available in retail here?
Absolutely. At Uvagio, 70 Miracle Mile.
Oh, you can buy wines and to take out at Uvagio?
Chef Tanner's laughing at me because I just plugged. He liked that, don't you?
Shameless. I didn't realize that. So you can take alcohol off premise there?
You can. I do it all the time. Oh, you meant guests as well.
To buy.
Yes. Okay. Absolutely, yes.
okay. Well, that sounds terrific. And tell me, what else would you be drinking with, let's say, his queso? What do you call it? Queso. Mm-hmm. What would you have with that?
It's funny. I was thinking about that because you sort of blew me out of the water and popped that one on me. I was thinking a full-bodied white wine from Alsace, something that's got high acid to it, still has a lot of creaminess and fullness with to go with the cheese, but enough zesty acidity rip right through all that richness. So I think maybe a nice Pinot Gris by Boxler or something like that from Alsace, France.
Okay. Now... So let's get back to the game for a minute. And this is something, a question that I always have. Maybe you can help us. You're serving all these snacks and everybody's eating and they're walking around watching the game and eating and all. And then if I'm going to serve my chili, when do I serve it? During halftime, everybody wants to watch Madonna. So give us some timing on this game plan thing.
Basically, Madonna's better than Coldplay from where I'm sitting anyway. it just depends. I mean, obviously, I think people are going to sort of nosh and go through the whole time. But obviously, I think you want to do something that's a little more heartier, spicier, and richer at the end of the meal. Same thing we always talk about with the food and wine pairings. So, I'd sort of try to save the chili between the third and the fourth quarter. Personally, I don't know about you, Tanner.
Yeah, I think a bowl of chili would be perfect right after halftime. Sit down and then and really settle in and get your spot on the couch so you don't have to get up so you can watch the rest of the game.
You got to get your spot. That's important. Right, yeah. I wouldn't mess with you getting a spot, I'll tell you. He's like, what is he, 6 feet?
Well, I think Joe and I are capable of chewing and watching the game at the same time.
Oh, you think? Okay.
Oh, yeah. But you don't want to be too bottomed out in the third quarter, though.
Well, yeah, you don't want to overdo it in the first quarter because that makes it kind of rough later.
You got to pace yourself.
He's looking at me because he doesn't think I understand what he's talking about.
I'm a little scared about bottomed out myself.
All right. Well, we're going to go to a break here. I'm Linda Gassenheimer. My guests today are Chef Tanner Gill and sommelier Heath Porter from Uvagia Wine Bar. We'll take a short break and we'll be back with more. And we're back. I'm Linda Gassenheimer. And our guests today are from Uvagio Wine Bar in Coral Gables, Chef Tanner Gill, and their head wino, insists on being called head wino instead of sommelier, is Heath Porter. And they've been giving us tips on our Super Bowl bash for this Sunday. Well, it's dinner in minutes time, and here's a quick and easy dish for any day, but it's really great for Super Bowl. You could even make it now and put it in your refrigerator or freeze it. It's a spicy mushroom and chicken chili, and the mushrooms give it a lot of texture and flavor, and I use the chicken thighs because they're a lot juicier. I cut them into small pieces, and I sauté them in a skillet for just a few minutes. Then I add some canned diced tomatoes, some chopped jalapeno pepper, some red kidney beans from a can, some frozen corn kernels, some chili powder, cumin, garlic, and mushrooms. It's so simple. You just put it all in there, and it cooks for about 15 minutes. You can serve that with a little chopped cilantro, maybe some sour cream.
Are you supposed to put mushrooms in chili?
Well, listen, I put chicken in.
New day and age, nobody knows.
Probably turkey, too.
It gives you a lot of flavor, a lot of texture, without quite so many calories, so you can have the other stuff you're going to be eating.
She's got to meet her guidelines.
Right. But you could use real meat, right?
We're talking about this recipe here, and you can get the complete... I'm in the studio with all these men. There's a lot of men here, including Fred on the telephone. Anyway, complete recipe and a photo, dinnerinminutes.com. And please follow me on Twitter. That's at L. Gassenheimer. And by the way, you can make this chili, and you don't have to tell anybody what's in it because it tastes so good. Fred Tasker, what are we drinking today?
Well, first, I understand that our guests are going to be at the South Beach Wine and Food Festival doing something they call a sommelier slam, and I wonder if we could get them to give us a brief description of what that is.
Absolutely, but first of all, we are nowhere near cool enough or sophisticated enough to be sommelier slam, so we'll just go with som slam, and it's a lot easier for us to spell, too. And it's a cool little thing that we came up with that we do around the wine bar, where Chef Tanner and another visiting chef will cook three courses. I'll invite some other unknowing sommelier to come in and throw him into the fire, and we'll both pair a wine with each course.
Well, it's actually not going to be at the restaurant. Is it? It's going to be at where?
So we do it at the restaurant most of the time, and then they've caught on to it at the South Beach Food and Wine Festival, and they've actually invited us to do a pop-up at the Ritz-Carlton. So they're doing Somm Slam at the Sobey Food and Wine Festival, and they're bringing in a big shot wine guy from New York, Anthony Giglio, to challenge us in our own backyard. So we're sort of excited about the throwdown.
So
I understand that the audience at this event gets to drink and eat the food and wine that you're talking about.
Actually, they're the judges, about. Fred. Well, they actually vote on the winner of each course for the pairings, and best two out of three, no holds barred, and there's a lot of smack talk going in.
Smack
How many
talk?
Guests do you expect at the event?
We're thinking it sold out at 75, so I'm betting standing room only around 100.
That's going to be a lot of wine.
And you don't even know what they're going to get to drink.
Yeah, I imagine so. Well, that sounds like a great event.
So, Chef Tanner, are you going to be bringing the food there? Are you going to be cooking it at the hotel? How does that work?
Well, actually, a lot of preparation has kind of already gone into this. We've been preparing for it for a while. Some of the stuff is being made currently as we speak. There's going to be a couple of things that I'll finish off kind of last minute right there. It's a little challenging because, you know, the restaurant, we usually do about 30 to 35 people for one of these events, and this is going to be closer to 100, so it's going to be a little bit of a challenge. We're going to do a couple of things there, but most of the stuff is going to be almost already. Well, a lot of the stuff's already been being worked on, so.
Well, so that's going to be on February 27th at 2 p.m., at the Ritz-Carlton, and
actually high noon. They told me noon.
Sorry, you're so, right.
My bad.
Yes, okay. No. What did I say, 2 p.m.?
Yes, ma'am.
It's 12. You're right. Thank you.
You don't have to yell at me. I'm sorry. I didn't mean it. I'm so sorry.
And it's $85 per person to go, and you can purchase them at sobefest.com, SOBEFEST.com, and you can join in. But you have these Somm Slams, rather, at the restaurant? How do you do that?
We do them at the wine bar pretty much every quarter, so every 3 or 4 months. And you know, they usually sell out within 2 or 3 hours of the tickets going on sale. And we really, I call it WWF meets food and wine. There's usually a lot of wine getting thrown around and a lot of trash talking.
He sure isn't pretentious at all, is he?
No.
I'm stuffy as I can be, damn you.
Did you? This is public radio.
Oh, I'm sorry. Excuse me.
I've been working on some wine food matches for the Super Bowl myself. Every year I have to make the argument that wine is a better match for Super Bowl snacks than the wimpy light beer that they talk about on all the TV ads that day. So I was looking into what kind of wine goes with some various things, and one of the most popular things, according to Google, at the Super Bowl are pigs in blankets, which are basically biscuit dough wrapped around cocktail weenies. And I was kind of stumped there a little bit, so I Googled a match for it, and I found wine bloggers, of all things, recommending a dry rosé sparkling wine. And after pondering that for a while...
Why did I think that you were going to come up with something sparkling, Fred? You got it in there. I'm glad.
The nectar of the gods.
Okay.
You serve it nice and cold. But here's the problem that I have, and I want to ask our guests about this. Buffalo chicken wings. Now, I was at the Anchor Bar in Buffalo, New York, one time where they were invented, and their recipe calls for Frank's Red Hot Chili Sauce, vinegar, Worcestershire sauce, garlic, and cayenne pepper. So it's not just spicy, it's also acidic, and I really can't come up with a wine match. You know, the rule of thumb is that super spicy foods call for wines that are slightly sweet, but I really can't picture chicken wings with an off-dry Riesling. And I don't want to give up and recommend beer. So, Tanner and Heath, do you have a solution for this?
Tanner, should I jump on this one, or you want to swing at it?
You can take this one, Heath.
All right. Actually, I did something similar a few months ago for a different article. And going with your residual sugar statement, it would be easy to go to a off-dry Riesling, especially something from upstate New York since you're in Buffalo. But we actually went with a Vouvray from the Loire Valley. A little bit lighter acidity, a little more firm body weight to it, all kinds of apple peachy goodness, and I found that it just really smoked the vinegar and the spice on the chicken wings. Really cool.
That had just a little bit of sweetness to it, right?
Just enough to recognize, not enough to send you to the dentist.
Oh, great. That sounds like a good match.
Cool. Let's do it. Bring the wings.
So
well,
what
then
about
the other thing I found in when Googling Super Bowl is that for dessert, during the fourth quarter, you're supposed to have a chocolate tiramisu cake, and it has to be in the shape of a football, including laces made of white frosting.
Where did you find a tiramisu that you had to have a tiramisu cake?
Well, I just Googled the most popular Super Bowl.
Lots of ads for Google today.
That's what popped up. So I was going to say that with this, you should probably serve coffee so you can drive home safely.
It's probably a good idea. Well, what about your pizza? What are we going to have with drinking with pizza if you're not going to have your beer?
Well, you know, I found that pizza is that Super Bowl Sunday is the fourth biggest day of the year for pizza after only Halloween, Thanksgiving Eve, and New Year's Day. So I think that for a meat top pizza, I would use a nice soft red Chianti because that would be Italian wine with Italian pizza. And for veggie pizza with a lot of cheese, maybe a fat California Chardonnay would work.
Oh, boy.
What do you think, Heath? Yes?
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to say that out loud. Excuse me. I don't like that at all, though. Sorry.
Oh, yeah, Fred, he doesn't like it.
We were talking about matching your cheese dip with a high acid wine to cut through it.
Yeah, I'm very much an acid head. I see your Chianti, and I like that. I think I'd probably go Sicilian on it and get into a nice, cool little Nero d'Avola Frappato blend or something like that. I totally see that. But I was thinking bubbles all the way, getting into some sparkling wine. Same representation as the beer that bubbles and the Frizzante just rips right through that greasy oiliness and really freshens the palate up. I think you just get straight into some Cremant de Jura or a little bit of champagne and go for it.
Okay. Well, let me ask you, is it true that at the Vagia Wine Bar that you choose all the wines and then Chef Tanner has to create food to go with the wine? Is the other way around?
That's backwards from what we
normally do?
That's the basis of the concept. Is I'll pick up a bunch of different wines that we're going to feature by the glass or by the season or whatnot, and then Chef gets the ideal pleasure of sitting down and tasting through them, and we just sort of start bouncing ideas around, and that's sort of what drives the backbone of the concept. It's not always...
Well, that's how you can tell it's a real wine lover, when you choose the wine and then have the food to go with the wine.
Absolutely.
The other way around.
Absolutely.
Okay, and I just... We're almost out of time, but of course I had to find out what we're going to have for dessert if we're not having the tiramisu football cake.
Well, if you're coming to Uvaggio, I would suggest doing a cinnamon bun bread pudding. That's what we like to serve around there. Make some cinnamon buns.
Okay, well, you can make it at home. Just take some cinnamon buns, some custard, and cook it up, right? Well, I'd love to find out more about that recipe, but we're out of time. It's been a really tasty week. Chef Tanner Gill, thank you so much for joining us.
You're welcome.
And for the wonderful brisket that's been eaten up in front of me by Joe Cooper. Heath Porter, thank you for the great wine tips and the wine.
Cheers, thanks.
Good luck on your Psalm Slam. Uvaggio is located at 70 Miracle Mile in Coral Gables. Joe Cooper, great to be with you. Fred Tasker, great advice as always. Next week, we're going to be talking about hot and spicy Valentine's food with celebrity chef Rick Bayless. I'm Linda Gassenheimer. Join me then.
And thanks for joining us. Our Opa-locka segment was produced by Polly Landis. Technical direction provided by online producer Paul Leary. Lead producer Richard Ives contributed as well. Don't forget about our free audio archives for download. That's at our website, WLRN.org, and more information, links, and photos at the Topical Currents Facebook page. So Bonnie and I return Monday for a program with former WLRN-based NPR correspondent Eric Weiner. He's now a travel writer and author, so we'll discuss his new book, The Geography of Genius, a search for the world's most creative places, from Athens to Silicon Valley. And we hope you enjoyed it. Joseph Cooper here. Bonnie returns on Monday. Saying so long for Linda Gassenheimer and Fred Tasker. Stay tuned for Here and Now, next from NPR News.